From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, 100 things to love and hate about television. We talk with Ken Tucker about his new book, Kissing Bill O'Reilly, Roasting Miss Piggy. Ken is Fresh Air's rock critic and film critic for New York Magazine. He was the TV critic for Entertainment Weekly from its founding in 1990 until last October. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz considers the work of the French composer and conductor Pierre Boulez. In the 1950s, he was the avant-garde's most outspoken critic of the establishment. Now he's one of the world's most admired musicians. He turns 80 next month. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Everyone has strong opinions about television and what its best and worst shows are. Critic Ken Tucker has written a book that describes his own complex feelings about the state of television by dividing the TV world into the programs he loves and those he hates. To give you a sense of how unpredictable some of his opinions are, his book is called Kissing Bill O'Reilly, Roasting Miss Piggy. Ken is Fresh Air's rock critic. He was the TV critic for Entertainment Weekly from its founding in 1990 until last October. He's now the film critic for New York Magazine. Why did you decide to organize this book into categories of things that you love and things that you hate?
Well, because so much of the talk about television is that it's the passive medium, that people are couch potatoes, when actually I think television stirs up a lot of very, very strong emotions. And so I really wanted to pick things that I felt extreme about that I passionately loved, that I passionately hated. And I hoped in that way to kind of spark an argument or agreement or disagreement with the reader.
Okay, well, your title demonstrates that one of the things you say you love in the book is Bill O'Reilly. And in your entry about Bill O'Reilly, you call him a jerk of the first rank. You say that you vehemently disagree with him politically. So what exactly do you like?
I like the fact that he is a real throwback to old broadcasters like Art Linkletter and Arthur Godfrey, in the sense that he makes a real personal connection to audiences. He looks straight at the camera. He talks straight at the audience. I think he's a really good broadcaster. I'm always surprised at people who can't separate his politics from what he does as a performer. And I think that the format of this show, it's brilliantly produced, I think. You have text running along the right side of the screen, which is almost unheard of when he has those talking points memos, so you have to kind of read along with him, which focuses your attention on him. So I think The O'Reilly Factor is a brilliantly produced program, even though, as you say and I say in the book, you know, would I be a good East Coast media critic if I did not vehemently disagree with almost everything that actually comes out of his mouth?
I want to read something you say about him. You write, he is at once arrogant and avuncular, ruthlessly aggressive and assiduously polite, shameless and racked with shame, a know-it-all liar and a knowing TV communicator. He is at once imperial and insecure. So you see him as a bunch of paradoxes.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of contradictions to him. He's a guy who, you know, famously has shouted shut up at people numerous times on the air. He's someone who also reads his mail and reads as much negative mail about his show as positive mail. I think that he's very... politically, he's hard to pin down in the sense that he may be politically conservative, but on social issues, he's sort of squishy to progressive. And, you know, he really can't figure him out. And I think that's part of his success. I think he's managed to lasso that. He talks a right-wing game, but actually practices a more libertarian view.
It sounds like part of what you think works about him as a broadcaster is that he's tough on guests, but he really flatters his audience by the way he directly talks with them and kind of flatters them and tells them he's looking out for them. So he tries to get the audience on his side, and then he shows how combative he is by attacking other people. But he's always really nice to the audience who he's talking directly to.
Yes, very, very flattering. Always bringing them over to his side. And, you know, I think it's always also this kind of false humility where he refers to himself as the factor, which I think is both funny and very canny. It's not all me, me, me. It kind of deflects it in a way. And I think that people really like that kind of attack approach that he takes to a lot of guests. They say to themselves, that's what I would do if I was on camera. I'd really, you know, go after that guy. So he's managed to put himself on the side of the audience, even though he, you know, he couldn't be more different and more aloof from the public than he probably is.
I'll repeat that you call him a know-it-all liar. Should not that overshadow everything else?
You know, if you're toting up the board of moral sins, yes. But I think as a broadcaster, as a communicator, I think part of the fun, the challenge, the seriousness of watching his show is catching him out on his falsehoods, calling him on it, and seeing through that argument. Now, I grant that the millions of people who love him probably buy into his arguments completely. But I think that the airwaves are better for a Bill O'Reilly because he's so much different from so many other commentators in that he has actual content in what he's saying. The stuff can be parsed, as Al Franken and other people have shown and exposed for what they are, but at least there's some content there, unlike someone like, say, Tucker Carlson, who I just find to be a kind of empty bow tie.
Okay, as if you haven't already surprised our audience enough with your with the fact that Bill O'Reilly is in the column of things that you love, you don't particularly like public television, and you say you have no sympathy for PBS. What's your problem with PBS?
I think that PBS has completely backed down so many times over the past, 20 years, again and again, in any kind of controversy. They will back down. They will edit things. I say in the book that I choked on a bag of Cheetos while I was watching one of these fundraisers I just came across by accident because I'd virtually stopped watching PBS. And I thought, they're still raising money? Who do they expect to get money from? They're showing these, old Lawrence Welk specials. The thing I happened to tune into was a Jack Parr salute that was edited and cut within an inch of its life so that they could break in and do these promos begging you for money. And PBS really has not produced enough original programming. They used to just going back to the 60s, shows like The Great American Dream Machine, which were political satires and things that you would just never see on PBS now. And I think at the very least, they could dip back into their treasure trove of shows that they have. When Masterpiece Theater really was putting on good adaptations, I thought when Julia Child died, the logical thing would be to immediately put a lot of vintage Julia Child shows on the air, that people would really love to experience that again. And instead, she got kind of the merest nod. I think it's become. I think that PBS has ceded so much territory to cable. They've said, the nature shows. There's cable shows that now do nature, so we can't do that anymore. And they change the time periods of things all the time. Masterpiece Theater. My poor old mother used to have a terrible time finding Mystery, her favorite show, and they kept yanking it around. I just think it's a very badly managed, cowardly network.
Now, Howard Stern ends up in the hate and love category in the sense that you love him on radio, hate him on television. What's the difference?
The difference is that on television, he is just so focused on the vulgar side of his persona of presenting naked girls and leering and doing, past gas jokes and stuff like that, it counteracts what's really valuable about Stern, which is his social criticism. I think he's never been better than now than he's come under attack by the FCC. Like O'Reilly, he kind of appeals to a right-wing working-class audience, but really has brought them around. He's come around 180 degrees in the past year politically. He used to support Republican candidates down the line, and now he's become this liberal free speech proponent, very articulate yet very funny. I mean, people thought that once he started crusading against the FCC, which was fining him and attacking him, that he'd become a big bore. I find those to be the most fascinating segments of his show now, when he inveighs against government regulation and calls for Michael Powell's resignation. I think that he had a very important part in Michael Powell's resignation. It was probably a factor, so to speak.
You also like Howard Stern's celebrity interviews.
I do. He digs much deeper than any talk show host, any nighttime talk show host. And I like the fact that the celebrities, once they caught on to the fact that they kind of get into the spirit of it. You have celebrities who will go on and submit to the most ferocious personal questioning, and why they answer, I don't know, but I think it's partly because Howard is so disarming and himself so self-revealing and self-deprecating that they kind of join in, the celebrities. And so you avoid all this promotion that goes on the shows like Entertainment Tonight and Access Hollywood and the late night talk shows. And I think Stern's just a brilliant guy in terms of squeezing out facts from celebrities that you would never hear anywhere else.
My guest is critic Ken Tucker. His new book is called Kissing Bill O'Reilly, Roasting Miss Piggy. We'll talk more about television after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ken Tucker. He's Fresh Air's rock critic. He's also a film critic for New York Magazine, former television critic for Entertainment Weekly, and now he has a new book about television called Kissing Bill O'Reilly, Roasting Miss Piggy, 100 Things to Love and Hate About TV. American Idol is back on TV. It's doing very well in the ratings. You really love Simon Cowell. You hate American Idol. Do you admire Simon Cowell as a critic?
As a critic, yes. You know, he's British, so we cut him a lot of slack, Americans do, you know. And he is sort of posited on that show as the show's villain. But at the same time, he does offer succinct criticism of these singers in a way that you never hear. I mean, he goes against the grain of everything that we're taught elsewhere on television, which is that everybody's special and everybody has talent and that you did a good job. You may not sing really well, but you did a fine job. That's what the other two judges do. Cal just says, you know, really, this is just absurd. You have a very bad voice. You should find another line of work. Go away. As for the show itself, I really detest American Idol. I think the music that's on display, of course, I'm speaking as somebody who really likes rock and roll. I think that the music is the worst kind of middle of the road schlock, and that it prizes most the kind of over enunciated, over emotionalized singing that I think it dates back at least as far back as someone like Whitney Houston holding a note too long, the melodramatic, melismatic notes that just, you know, make your heart stop because they're just lasting way too long and it's just too annoying and saccharine.
Let me quote what you write about American Idol. You write, an entire generation of young people has now grown up thinking that the closed eyes croon, the insincere melisma, the exaggerated gestural mannerism, and songs chosen for their bombast content are the best ways to entertain America. Ah, so what's wrong with that?
It's sort of the worst of both worlds because, you know, it doesn't have the kind of freedom and challenge and rebelliousness of rock music. But it's also not as if it's introducing people to old standards, the kind of subtle swinging phrasing of, you know, great popular singers like Sinatra or Tony Bennett. And so to me, it just falls right in the middle. And the show's just become worse in its structure. They draw out for weeks all those early auditions where you see all the bad singers. And I'm really convinced that they let in so many ringers who come on knowing they'll be bad and will get camera time. So I think the whole thing's completely fixed in the early stages. And then when they narrow it down, they just narrow it down to whoever is, you know, got the biggest, most booming voice and that sort of phone-in vote that, you know, just, oh, gosh, it just really makes me despair for America.
Two of the really popular cult shows on television that have had really long lives and spinoffs and movies you hate. One of them Star Trek, one of them The Brady Bunch. And you think The Brady Bunch is actually not only like the worst series on the history of television, but that it's kind of generated a whole aesthetic that you hate. So what's that aesthetic?
That aesthetic is the, it's so bad, it's good. You know, it's so junky and cheap and tacky that I just love it. It's that sort of camp approach that I really detest. There's a whole younger generation that thinks anything schlocky is kind of cool. And so the Brady Bunch, a lot of people were brought up on the Brady Bunch. And, you know, this was this really cheaply produced show. If there wasn't a laugh track, you really would have no idea where a punchline was in the Brady Bunch. It was about this, you know, blended family and this. It was just the worst kind of bland sitcom. And to have this through the power of syndication and the power of, I think, gradual sociological changes in which more women went into the workforce, more kids were put in front of the TV set, and they were, you know, raised by sitcoms like The Brady Bunch, and they can't distinguish between the fact that this is stuff that they watched 25 times and the fact that it's good. Just the fact that it's so familiar, that they know every single episode, people think it must be good because it's stuck in my mind for so long. No, I'm sorry. It's garbage that's stuck in your mind for so long.
Well, but one of the interesting things about television is that you start watching it when you're really young, and things just get imprinted into your brain. I mean, it has this kind of special place in your brain because, well, in part because you're so impressionable when you're young, and it's a part of the mental environment you've grown up with. So I think you just develop an automatic affection in a way for shows you saw when you were young, whether you liked them or not.
I think that's true, and I think that's what distinguishes television from other mediums like music or the movies, where you have to make an active decision to put down your money, to buy a CD, to buy a movie ticket. Television is there. It's in your living room. A lot of times you just get exposed to stuff that you didn't really expect you were going to watch, and you sort of get hooked. I also think that there's a kind of false nostalgia that builds up. That's part of what I'm talking about with the Brady Bunch. But even in sort of what I wanted to do was, you know, I'm 50 years old. I was raised on things like, when I was a kid, I loved Westerns. So I went to the Museum of Television when I was researching this book, and I looked at things that I remember really loving, like Steve McQueen in Wanted Dead or Alive. And I thought, when I was a kid, I thought this was the coolest thing in the world, was to have a sawed-off shotgun that you would carry alongside of your right leg, and you could just blow away anybody who bothered you. To a little boy, this was like just a wonderful thing. And I watched Steve McQueen in this, and it was just awful. It was just so the corny. The same was true of a Western like Bonanza that I used to like. It was just terrible. Then there are things that do hold up. I watched reruns of The Rifleman with Chuck Connors, which was another show that I really liked. And those are really beautifully done, spare, almost classical sort of Howard Hawksy little mini Westerns. And I realized, looking at the credits, that more than half of those shows were written and directed by Sam Peckinpah, who went on to do a lot of great movies.
Did music and movies and television and books always matter to you a lot?
They mattered a huge amount. It was really kind of my escape. I wasn't an athletic kid. I had that kind of difficult relationship with my father. And so it was always something that I could escape to. They were very important things. I was always interested in the arts. I was never a performer. I did a little acting. I played the flute in junior high school. You know, so I had these kind of very minimal kind of things. But I really found the pleasure of writing, the pleasure of what I really learned from Robert Christgau at the Village Voice, was the best line editor I ever had was, you work on every single sentence and everything had to be absolutely airtight before you go on to the next sentence. And I would finish a piece, I would think it would be closed, and Christgau would literally call me up and say, in the second paragraph, the third line, I'm going to change the semicolon to a period because I think it should stop there. And I've done a certain amount of editing, and that's how I learned to edit, which is to pay a respect to the writer and to even when you make so minor a change as a semicolon to a period, the writer should be informed.
Were you offended at first that your writing needed to be gone over word by word and that your editor, Robert Christgau, was going to make a change probably in every sentence early on instead of appreciating
No.
it? Did you feel offended?
Early on, I was so insecure. I literally, this first piece that I handed in to him was this long piece because I had criticized him for neglecting a whole kind of middle area of rock and roll. There was a place on 14th Street in Manhattan called the Academy of Music that had these kind of middle of the road acts like Black Oak, Arkansas, and Fog Hat, these hard rock acts that everybody disdained. And I said, "You're not covering this." And so he said, "You cover it. Go spend a month at the Academy of Music and watch every single show and write about what it's like to spend a month watching everything from Fog Hat to a then very green Bruce Springsteen on the stage of the Academy of Music." And that's what I did. And so it took me a month of watching the shows and then writing this piece. And I handed this review in, and then I immediately, I remember dropping it off at the front desk of the Village Voice, going back home, calling him up and leaving him a message saying, "It's terrible. I know you're never going to print it. I'm sorry," and hanging up. And he called me up and he said, "Don't you ever call an editor and put down your work in advance. Don't ever do that again. This is a perfectly good piece, and now we're going to make it better." And so I was so grateful for that kind of editing. Of course, now I've become like such a pro that now it's like, you know, I do bristle when somebody wants to change something because I think, "I've been doing this for years. I'm a pro." You know, who are you to mess with my beautiful golden prose?
Ken Tucker is former TV critic for Entertainment Weekly. He's now film critic for New York Magazine. And, of course, he's Fresh Air's rock critic. His new book is called Kissing Bill O'Reilly, Roasting Miss Piggy. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, featuring the AARP Crash Course in Estate Planning, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Paperbacks, publisher of Hallowed Bones, a mystery set in the Mississippi Delta by Carolyn Haynes, author of Crossed Bones. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz considers the work of composer and conductor Pierre Boulez. He turns 80 next month. Also, Ken Tucker talks about pop music on television. He's a rock critic and a TV critic.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ken Tucker. His new book describes his complex feelings about television by dividing the TV world into programs that he loves and ones that he hates. It's called Kissing Bill O'Reilly, Roasting Miss Piggy. Ken is Fresh Air's rock critic. He was TV critic for Entertainment Weekly from its founding in 1990 until last October. He's now film critic for New York Magazine. Now, Ken, since you've been a rock critic, still are a rock critic, as well as having been a TV critic and now a film critic, I'm wondering about the impact of seeing musicians on television. Like, what are some of the touchstone music moments from your childhood watching television?
Well, I think I share a lot of things with millions of other people, like seeing the Beatles for the first time on Ed Sullivan, I was a little young for Elvis Presley, but I saw some of Elvis Presley. I certainly saw Elvis Presley's incredible 1968 comeback special, when the one where he's in black leather and he had slimmed down and was just him and his backing musicians in this very kind of spontaneous setting. But you know, television is an inherently conservative medium, and so especially in the 50s and 60s and early 70s. There was something exciting about seeing a rock and roll act on television, because you thought at any moment all hell could break loose, because rock and roll was just so rebellious and it didn't really fit on television. Soon enough, both the rock industry and TV tamed that. One of the very earliest examples of a rock and roll musician on television was Ricky Nelson on The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet. And I used to love that, because you'd watch, 25 minutes of Ozzie and Harriet, which was produced and directed by Ozzie Nelson, the father. He basically put the whole family to work. And then in the last 5 minutes, you would often have, apropos of absolutely nothing, there'd be some inane, silly, charming plot that Ozzie and Harriet would go through. And then Ricky Nelson would come on with his guitar, embossed with Ricky on the guitar, and he had James Burton, Elvis Presley's guitarist, behind him, and he'd do these great rockabilly numbers, these great rock and roll numbers that would almost completely contradict what had come before in the preceding half hour. So I thought Ricky Nelson was a great TV presence.
You mean in the sense that the preceding half hour was all about, being a good nuclear family and living in a nice suburban home, and then he'd do this rockabilly number.
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned one particular episode that's all about at a certain point in real life, Rick Nelson got married, of course, the wife became part of the show. And the plot was all about how he had somehow gotten in the doghouse, he'd forgotten something. At one point, she actually picks up, it was the most cliche thing in the world, she picks up a frying pan and chases him around the kitchen for, forgetting her birthday or something like that. Then, fade to black, go to commercial, come back, and Ricky Nelson sings this song about how he's a happy guy because he can go wherever the four winds blow. That's why I'm a happy man. And it's all about him being completely footloose and single. And it's like this fantasy of like, man, if I could only escape my father, the producer, and this wife, I could really bust out. I thought it was great.
Here's another kind of surprising program that comes in the love column in your list of loves and hates on television. It also has to do with music, and that's Hee Haw. You really love Hee Haw for what?
For what, she says in disbelief. For the fact that it showcased a lot of really good country music stars, and, there was no place else to see people like Buck Owens and Merle Haggard and Porter Wagoner, just real classic old hardcore country acts at that time. Granted, it was framed around this sort of country ripoff of Rowan Martin's Laugh-In, blackout sketches, lots of corny cornball humor. But even that, I thought, was almost more, it was easier to take than the Rowan and Martin, we're a couple of slick nightclub comics who've lucked into the 60s zeitgeist and have Goldie Hawn in a bikini boogalooing around. To me, there was something, in a weird way, more authentic about Hee Haw, produced in Nashville with true hayseeds. People like Grandpa Jones, who was like a really good bluegrass banjo player who was one of the hosts. Minnie Pearl, who was really the host of the Grand Ole Opry for years and years and a very funny comedian. So these were authentic performers, and I thought that that Hee Haw always got a bad rap because, you know, it was supposed to be so corny and cornball, when actually it showcased a lot of really good music.
My guest is Ken Tucker. He's Fresh Air's rock critic. He's the film critic for New York Magazine, former television critic for Entertainment Weekly. Now he has a new book about television that divides television into things he loves and things he hates. It's called Kissing Bill O'Reilly, Roasting Miss Piggy. Ken, you've been a rock critic, TV critic, and now film critic. Let's talk a little bit about some of the stylistic differences in each form, if you feel that there are. I mean, like, rock criticism started with, I think it's fair to say, a more, like, youthfully defiant, bad boy kind of style, whereas, you know, television and film criticism is a much older form of criticism that probably had a lot more to do with daily newspapers early on, or maybe weekly magazines than... You know, a lot of rock criticism was the alternative weeklies where it started. So are there differences, having worked in all of these forms? Are there differences?
There are big differences. I mean, I started out as a rock critic because I liked the music. And as you say, a lot of it was being published in alternative newspapers. So when I was just coming out of college with this useless English degree, I thought to myself, well, what am I going to do? And I thought, well, I like to write and I like music. So I just sent an idea to the Village Voice, and the editor there, Robert Christgau, said, do this, write this up. And it was my first published piece. And I like the fact that rock and roll was kind of, rock criticism was criticism that was being kind of made up on the fly. On the one hand, you had very thoughtful criticism by people like Robert Christgau and Greil Marcus that were based on a kind of literary criticism-based theories. And then on the other hand, you had wild men like Lester Bangs, who just wanted to kind of explode the form, to do in prose what rock and roll was doing at the time, which was exploding past all kinds of boundaries of what was supposed to be considered good music. And so it was a very liberating time to write about rock and roll, I think, in the early to late 70s, especially again when punk rock came around. There was a kind of infusion of energy. When you write about television, it's a completely different sort of thing, in the sense that you're writing about an inherently more conservative medium, and you have to deal with personalities that millions and millions of people know. A lot of times in rock and roll, you're sort of introducing people. You have to, the challenge is to describe music in ways that aren't technical but are vivid and precise, and that summon up what a sound is. With television, much more often, all you're doing is being an informed fellow viewer. You're saying to someone, look, I know you've watched this, I've watched this, we watched this together. Here's what I think about it. Bounce your opinion off mine. Now I find when I write about movies, the challenge now I'm finding is, it's the opening weekend of a movie, so I can't presume that somebody's seen this the way I can that they've seen, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer or The O.C. So now I have to give a plot description in as quick and vivid a way as I can. I have to set it all up, what's going on here, and then provide also some kind of context and judgment. So there are three very separate kind of challenges.
How did you first become aware that criticism existed?
Pretty early on, I was really attracted to the idea of criticism. I had read people like Pauline Kael. Wilfred Sheed used to write wonderful book reviews. And I grew up in a household where my father was a very dominating figure and very, very domineering, very harsh guy, very quick to put people down. And when I look back on it, not to psychoanalyze myself too much, but I realized that one of the ways I felt I could defend myself was to become more articulate. I had to stand toe-to-toe with my father to argue with him. And I think that hones a kind of critical skill that then when you go out into the world, you know, it's like, I was a working class kid, and it was like the lower middle class version of being on the debate team. So if I could argue with my father and then transpose this love of writing and then what rapidly became a love of criticism of the work of people like Pauline Kael and Dwight MacDonald, who wrote wonderfully about movies, Manny Farber, just an incredible stylist who could write about both movies and art wonderfully, then this was something to really aspire to. To me, criticism was a real calling at a certain point.
What were some of the things you'd argue with your father about?
Oh, he hated most rock and roll. The only person he liked was Elvis Presley. Other than that, it was country music. And so, therefore, for years, I hated country music just in reaction to my father. It was a knee-jerk reaction. And I was forever, you know, bringing home Rolling Stones records and The Love and Spoonful and people like that and just, you know, trying my best to sort of drive him crazy and see what the reaction would be. And he would, you know, put on Buck Owens and you know, I'd hear this Bakersfield wine, this, you know, Buck Owens singing, I've got a tiger by the tail, it's plain to see. And that this struck me as the ultimate in corn. And now I listen to Buck Owens and I think, this guy was doing something in Bakersfield, California that nobody was doing in Nashville. So in a lot of ways, my father gave me a great grounding in a certain kind of music, which I appreciated now only after his death. But in some ways, it also created the kind of spark that I needed to do the kind of work that I wanted to go on to do.
My guest is critic Ken Tucker. His new book is called Kissing Bill O'Reilly, Roasting Miss Piggy, 100 Things to Love and Hate About TV. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ken Tucker, Fresh Air's rock critic, film critic for New York Magazine, and former TV critic for Entertainment Weekly. His new book is called Kissing Bill O'Reilly, Roasting Miss Piggy, 100 Things to Love and Hate About TV. When you were living in Los Angeles earlier in your career, you covered the punk scene for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner. And this was like the late 70s, early 80s. And, that was the extreme music of its day. And I've been working with you for years since you've been, you know, working on Fresh Air. And so I know you a little bit. And you don't strike me as like an extreme personality outwardly. Who knows what happens inside? But
I'm the only guy who people used to literally know me in Los Angeles because I was the only guy who would bring a book to read in the mosh pit at punk concerts. And they knew it was okay to slam dance against me, but just don't jostle the book out of his hand.
So when you were covering punk rock and not being a kind of like physically outgoing person in the way that punk music is, and not being a loud person, did you feel uncomfortable or miscast at all? And did you want to get to know these people but feel like you were a different kind of person than they were?
I wanted to stay as far away from these people as possible. I mean, for a couple of reasons. I mean, I find in general it's always a bad idea for a critic to meet the person that he or she admires. Most of the interviewing I've done are people that I like. And then I find, oh, my gosh, then, you know, whether it's a month or a year later, they put out a bad record or a bad TV show. And I think, gee, I had such a pleasant time with that person. It's so difficult now to do that. A couple of things I've learned is, certainly in the art of interviewing, is that anybody can be charming to you for an hour. You know, I have interviewed people who've been just incredibly nice to me, and I'll walk out and then the door will close and I'll hear them, you know, screaming at an assistant or something. So everybody plays their roles that way. But as far as I was very intimidated, especially during the punk era, which was all about aggression. I loved it for its adrenaline. The music was just wonderful to write about, and it was really inspiring to listen to. But, you know, one time I interviewed Johnny Rotten / at that point John Lydon in his hotel room. And he was sitting on his hotel bed, and he he fixed on my name, and but sneeringly, of course, because it was Johnny Rotten. And he would say, "Well, Kentucky, what do you have to say for yourself today?" And we'd have this kind of back and forth, which was kind of adversarial. And literally, I'm warning your listeners that this may be slightly upsetting. But at one point, he just very calmly said, "Excuse me," and he'd been up like the whole night. And he was in the middle of a sentence, and he leaned over the side of the bed and he vomited. And he just, and then sort of wiped his mouth, turned back, and finished his sentence. And it was just like, I was like really not supposed to really acknowledge that this had occurred, apparently. And I said, "Are you feeling okay?" And he just, you know, kind of raised his eyebrows quizzically as if to say, you know, what's the problem here? And I just looked down at my notebook and asked the next question. So it's rock and roll, you know, it's a very dicey business.
Did you mention in your article that he vomited?
Yes, I did. Yeah. People really like that. They thought that, you know, that completely fit with their image of him. And, you know, for all I know, maybe it was a stunt on my for my benefit.
Well, I think it's hard to control that, so.
I think so, too.
One last question. Now that you don't have to watch TV because you're no longer a TV critic, you're a movie critic, what are some of the shows that you watch because you want to?
Oh, I still watch The Simpsons. I really like Arrested Development and Curb Your Enthusiasm among sitcoms. The Wire is just hands down the best television show on the air or off the air, and I hope it comes back. I like things that other people may my age may consider junk, like The OC, which I think is really well written and has great performances both by its young cast and the adults, especially Peter Gallagher. So I found it surprisingly easy to stop watching an enormous amount of television, but there are things that I still make sure I catch.
Ken, great to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you an awful lot, Terry.
Ken Tucker is the former TV critic for Entertainment Weekly and current film critic for New York Magazine. And, of course, he's Fresh Air's rock critic. His new book is called Kissing Bill O'Reilly, Roasting Miss Piggy, 100 Things to Love and Hate About TV. He loves Ricky Nelson singing on Ozzy and Harriet. Here's Nelson recorded in 1958.
I believe what you say when you say you're going steady with nobody else but me. I believe what you say when you say you don't kiss nobody else but me. I believe, I do believe, I believe, yeah, believe pretty baby. Believe you're going steady with nobody else but me. Well, there's one thing, baby, that I want you to know. When you're rocking with me, don't rock too slow. Move on and get toe-to-toe. We're gonna rock till we can't rock no more. I believe, I do believe, yeah, believe pretty baby. Believe you're going steady with nobody else but me. Well, let's dig it now.
Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz considers the career of composer and conductor Pierre Boulez, who's about to turn 80. This is Fresh Air. The French composer and conductor Pierre Boulez was once the avant-garde's most outspoken critic of the establishment. Now, as he's about to turn 80, he's become one of the world's most admired musicians, an opinion classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz shares. Lloyd has been listening to new discs of music performed by and written by Boulez. He's heard a memorable live concert in New York, and he even got to sit down and talk with the maestro.
What happens when an iconoclast becomes an icon? Composer and conductor Pierre Boulez has been the most articulate and provocative spokesperson for the musical avant-garde since the 1950s. 3 months after 9/11, he was actually dragged from his hotel room in Switzerland and arrested as a terrorist suspect at the age of 76, because some 40 years earlier he had made a widely quoted remark about blowing up opera houses, those bastions of the establishment. But now, Boulez's recordings win Grammys, and the very people who used to find him a cold perfectionist are praising his warmth and expressiveness. This year marks his 80th birthday on March 26th, and he'll be appearing in concerts all over Europe and the United States. This is good news for his admirers. 10 years ago, at a 70th birthday concert at Carnegie Hall, he led the London Symphony Orchestra in one of the works most closely associated with him, Stravinsky's revolutionary The Rite of Spring. I thought it was the greatest orchestral performance I'd ever heard, until I heard them do it again this year. With Boulez, this wasn't just music depicting a sacrificial ritual in ancient Russia, or an exercise in complex rhythm. It seemed to be about the way the universe functions, mysterious, spiritual, sexual, cataclysmic, also intimate and seductively beautiful. Here's an excerpt from Boulez's 1992 recording with the Cleveland Orchestra, which has just been reissued, and which captures some of the remarkable qualities of the live performance. To honor his landmark birthday, Boulez's record label, Deutsche Grammophon, is issuing 5 new recordings, 2 with Boulez conducting his own challenging, unsettling, but engagingly colorful and increasingly comprehensible work, as well as a recording of his 3 controversial early piano sonatas with the brilliant young Finnish pianist Paavali Jumppanen. There's also a disc of works by Mahler, whom Boulez regards as a bridge between 19th century Romanticism and 20th century Modernism, and one of Bartók, his 3 exhilarating piano concertos, each with a different soloist and orchestra. The Mahler disc, with Boulez conducting the Vienna Philharmonic, includes 3 song cycles. One of them, the exquisite and melancholy Songs of a Wayfarer, with German baritone Thomas Kvasthoff, is one of the subtlest and most moving vocal recordings I've ever heard. Even the orchestra sings.
Ging heut morgen übers Feld, tau noch auf den Gräsern hin, sprach zu mir der Lustgefind, ei du Geld. Guten Morgen, ei Held, du wird mich deine schöne Welt, flink, flink, schön und flink,
mag mir lustig guter Ding mit den Glöckchen klinge, kling, klinge, kling. Ihren Morgen uns bestellt, wird mich eine schöne Welt, schöne Welt. Doch die Welt gefällt. Heia!
While I was in New York for the Stravinsky concert, I got to talk to Boulez. I asked him how he achieved that all-embracing expansiveness I had felt so powerfully in The Rite of Spring. His first response was personal, that this music was very close to his heart, his first encounter with something radical, with modernity. Then he spoke more about technical matters, about pacing, not letting the climax get too fast or it would lose its sense of weight. And then this master of precision and rhythmic nuance, of color and clarity and detail, said, "Of course, one cannot really explain the mystery."
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. I'm Terry Gross. The last record by the late Ray Charles won 8 Grammys last night. We'll close with Ray Charles and Betty Carter, recorded in 1961, singing a perfect song for Valentine's Day.
In some secluded rendezvous that overlooks the avenue, with someone sharing a delightful chat of this and that. And cocktails for two.
Cocktails for two.
As we enjoy a cigarette to some exquisite chansonnette, two hands are sure to slyly meet beneath serviette with cocktails for two.
Cocktails for two.
My head will go reeling.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes. And from the Kauffman Center of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the coming battle over Supreme Court and judicial appointments. We talk with Ralph Neese of the liberal group People for the American Way. On Wednesday, we'll talk with C. Boyden Gray, founder of the conservative group The Committee for Justice. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.